You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers developments across all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All the comments are current at the time of podcast publication. It's brought to you by the barristers at 1 Crown Office Row, and this edition is presented by Emma Louise Fenlon.
Those practising or interested in the area of public law and human rights are likely to be aware of the Reith Lectures recently delivered by former UK Supreme Court Justice Jonathan Sumption. Over 5 episodes, available on the BBC at the time of recording, he addressed subjects such as law's expanding empire, challenges posed by human rights law, and the advantage of an unwritten constitution. The resulting debate has been fascinating. I would particularly encourage listeners to read Baroness Helena Kennedy's debate with Lord Sumption in Prospect magazine, linked in the blog post accompanying this episode, for a flavour of the debate. The Constitutional and Administrative Law Bar Association, or ALBA, recently hosted its annual summer law conference, and one of the many illustrious panels it hosted responded to these Reith Lectures. The panel featured Lord Dyson, Sir Stephen Laws, Lord Falconer, Professor Meg Russell, Professor Vernon Bogdaner, and was chaired by Mrs. Justine Thornton. We are enormously grateful to the chair and committee of ALBA and the panel participants for enabling us to record this session, as well as Lord Sumption's response to the panel in interview with Lord Justice Singh.
Good afternoon. Welcome to this session on judicial power, a response to the Reith Lectures. My name is Justine Thornton. I'm recently appointed to the High Court, and my job today is to chair the distinguished panel of speakers. Now, before we arrived here today, we have had a background discussion about the issues raised by the Reith Lectures, and I can see from our discussions already that this promises to be a lively session. So far, I've calculated only 2 points on which there is an unanimous view. The first is that Lord Sumption is the first lawyer to give the Reith Lectures since 1986. And the second is that his lectures have generated an impassioned debate. And that is indeed so. His lectures have been described as elitist, as advancing a deeply flawed neoliberal ideology, as giving a great thumping kick in the pants for liberal judges, and as changing the mind of one of the smartest left-wing commentators in the business. It's not often that law lectures generate that sort of reaction. So there's clearly much to unpick, and each speaker is going to focus on a different aspect of the lectures and speak for 5 minutes before we then turn to questions and debates. So without further ado, I'm going to turn first to Lord Falconer, who's going to consider the interface between law and politics and an overarching critique of Lord Sumption's thesis.
Justine, thank you. I welcome Lord Sumption in the audience. These lectures are incredibly important. They are, as Justine has said, the first time a lawyer in a generation has spoken about law to a wider audience, the Reith Lecture audience. And Lord Sumption went straight to the key issue about judges. Do they have too much power in our constitution? Are they exercising too much power in our constitution? His lectures, and in particular the second and the third lecture, which are the two I intend to focus on, advance a thesis that the judges have overextended their power, both under their own steam, judicial review and the way that they construe statutes, and secondly and separately, and this is in the third lecture, applying the Human Rights Act. In relation to the Human Rights Act, he vividly compares the Human Rights Act to communism or fascism in this sense that he says the jurisprudence of the Strasbourg court is in effect saying that there are principles that trump democracy, the precise argument that fascism and communism used, and that's what the Strasbourg court is doing conceptually in relation to the values that they espouse. Lord Sumption's analysis of the way that the courts have acted as a narrative over the last 50 years is accurate, save possibly to the extent that he attributes to the judges from time to time bad motives in relation to the construction of statutes. And by bad motives, I do not mean dishonourable motives. I mean deliberately thwarting the purpose of Parliament. I'm not sure whether they've done that or not, but Lord Sumption is a judge and I'm not, so he may know better than I in relation to what their motivation is. But I fundamentally disagree with Jonathan that the courts, meaning the judges, have taken a wrong turn over the last 50 years. I believe that in Britain, the courts have been incredibly well judged in increasing the grip that they have had on the executive and in a way which has broad public assent. Jonathan rightly says in his lecture, it would be wrong for the courts to seek to go beyond that which the public would assent to as far as the judges are concerned. And I agree with that. Can I just take three bits of his analysis? First, the courts have gone too far and in effect are reflecting the views of a particular caste that has no democratic legitimacy. He gives a number of examples. For example, he refers to the use of aid money, which is the Pyrgau Dam. He refers to publicly subsidised fares, which is the Fares Fair case in London. He refers to education, which I think is a reference to the Tameside case. What the courts have done over the last 40 or 50 years, I believe, is to hold the executive particularly to standards of decency, honesty, competence, non-discrimination, sticking by their word, where they create an expectation, abiding by it. Those principles are not the making of policy. They are holding the executive to account in the courts in a way that the politicians either do not or cannot, because the nature of a court case is you examine in detail a particular issue rather than skirt on the surface and think about principle. The greater and greater assertion of the court's willingness to hold the executive to account since the early 60s is, in my view, a reflection of the public's view that we should hold the executive to higher standards. That I am right in my assertion that this does not offend against public views about what the judges should be doing is reflected in the fact that the judges have high public support, much higher public support and respect than the politicians do. The second area is the Human Rights Act. And in relation to the Human Rights Act, that is something that Parliament agreed on. You all know the settlement that Parliament agreed on in relation to the Human Rights Act. Yes, the Strasbourg jurisprudence strays into areas, for example, prisoners' voting rights, that we would think might be going too far. But even Lord Sumption, in the lecture that he, lectures he advances, says that the basic human rights that any court should, in effect, give effect to are those that protect democracy and those that prevent, in effect, physical abuse or the arbitrary removal of freedom, property, or rights. In effect, this is an oversimplification, the only one that he is jibbing at is really Article 8, with all of the difficulties that Article 8 gives rise to. But Parliament has decided that Article 8 should be included. The courts have got to give effect to it. At bottom, in his propositions, is the idea that politicians are better at doing policy than the courts. The politicians can do nuance, they can do compromise, they mediate, to use Lord Sumption's language, differing views about a particular policy issue in a way that the courts cannot. The courts deal with right and wrong, the courts deal with law, the courts deal with particular principles. Yes, it's absolutely right that politicians can be better at that, But what the development of the human rights law and what the development of the court's willingness to attack the executive has indicated over the years, that there are certain principles, decency, fairness, honesty, competence, doing what you say, non-discrimination, that everybody agrees on, in a world where people are much more conscious of individual rights, the courts can and should give effect to it. I think it would be, with respect to Jonathan, disastrous if the view that Jonathan espouses, namely that the courts have gone too far, were to gain currency. I can see a lot of politicians who would think, let's go with that route. It is an absolute gift for those who saw the courts as the enemies of the people. The courts are not the enemies of the people. The courts have proved themselves to be the upholders of standards that almost everybody would agree with. And in the UK, we've done it without there being a revolutionary moment. We've done it without taking on the politicians. And we've done it successfully in a way that has not caused any constitutional disaster. So I applaud the judges in the way they've been over the last 50 years and ultimately deprecate the conclusions that Lord Sumption reached in the Reid lectures.
Sir Stephen Laws.
There's a great deal in the lectures I agree with. I come at this as a parliamentary drafter, including much cheered up by this morning of the Regulation of the Investigatory Powers Act. I work with the tensions between law and politics for more than 35 years. The oversimplification, law good, politics bad, is a dangerous error. I endorse the spirit of Lord Sumption's second lecture in praise of politics, and also the theme of them all, a concern that the law should not take on tasks that are better carried out in a political forum. Lawyers and politicians approach issues differently, but it is because they have different functions requiring different skills and different ways of thinking. Both approaches are needed in the legislative process. Legislation is never just about changing the law. That is always only a tool for achieving a political objective. The law otherwise operates principally for resolving disputes about the past, and so it puts a high value on predictability and consistency as guarantees of fairness, quite rightly. But that creates an inherent partiality for the status quo. It means law is good at stopping change, but not for deciding what is needed or what form it should take. For someone like me, who thinks change is necessary for survival, a radical, I suppose, the process is difficult enough without the distorting inhibitions of judicial regulation. The law is wrong to assume that you can work out where you should go from determining where you've been. That can only tell you where to start. It is politics, with its objective of improving things for the future, that has developed the approach needed for the initiation and management of change. The future has inherent elements of unpredictability and of inconsistency with what has gone before. Making it acceptable requires the deployment of both leadership and powers of persuasion. The judiciary's commitment to impartiality inhibits the use of those means to make its decisions on change acceptable. Instead, it must rely on the persuasiveness of its inherent authority, which, as the lecturers rightly acknowledge, lacks sufficient democratic legitimacy. I refute the usual excuses for enhancing the role of the law in political decision-making, the myth that democratic politics has failed or is somehow too risky. There is no plausible real-world risk of majoritarian tyranny in the UK, nor is it clear, as Lord Sumption said, that it would or could be restrained by judicial regulation if it were. But my concerns go beyond legitimacy. There are other risks in the rise of law to fill a void thought to have been created by a decline in politics. In the legislative process, I often saw a tension between law and politics when the focus of the lawyers was all on writing law with those who might contravene it in mind. The focus of politicians, by contrast, was always more on those they expected to comply with it. Legislation is only effective to produce real-world change when adopted largely willingly and constructed to secure the minimum waste of resources on enforcement. Our constitutional systems incentivise that approach, and so does a desire for effectiveness. A misconceived concentration on enforcement has other risks. Legislation will fail to achieve its real-world objective, where it tends to replace mature judgment with a culture of formal compliance and gaming the rules. Robert Peston's book on the financial crisis explains the disastrous consequences of an intended tightening of regulation on banking. Banking, he says, moved away from being almost exclusively based on an assessment of the creditworthiness of individual customers towards the development of strategies to maximise gross lending within what was allowed by the Basel rules. I would say, very forcefully, that what is true of regulating bankers is also true of trying to regulate the political process. My familiarity over 35 years with politicians did not breed contempt, but rather considerable respect, particularly for their acceptance of democratic accountability and of the values of persuading rather than imposing. It is a mistake to tempt them into minimising their exposure to blame by shifting responsibility onto rules or judges over which they can claim to have no control. We need politicians to act responsibly, but they cannot do that unless they are given responsibility. Change or successful resistance to it can only be effective through changing minds as well as rules. Politicians are better at that than judges, but they need to be accountable to be motivated to try it. I agree with Lord Sumption that there has been a decline in political engagement, and also with his scepticism about the value of a comprehensive written constitution. It would unnecessarily and undesirably draw the judiciary deeper into politics. I would suggest further that there is evidence that there is a vicious cycle being created in which the law's greater engagement with politics is offered as a response to a loss of public engagement with politics, but is actually aggravating the mischief it is purporting to remedy. Litigation that relies on judicial authority to impose solutions on political situations can provide more comprehensive political victories than political dialogue, negotiation, and compromise. That gives a boost to the appetite to do politics in the courts, which has grown and is growing. In my view, that is bad for politics, and because it involves the courts in politics, bad for the courts. Nor can the remedy be found in regulating only process. Process is inseparable from substance. That is why attempts to produce a comprehensive written constitution are not only undesirable, they are also doomed to failure. It is in practice impossible to draft any new decision-making process to produce impartiality as to its outcomes. I know, because I've been asked to do it several times and I've tried. As you draft, you test the new process against how it might work for different scenarios. You or your political clients then have to make decisions about which of the outcomes would make the new process better than the existing one. The result cannot be impartial. It's about deciding what change you want to make. Without consensus on the desired outcomes from any new constitution, which is obviously impossible, particularly at the moment, do we want a constitution that will make Brexit easier or one that would make it more difficult? Without that consensus, a comprehensive written constitution is just a fantasy.
Professor Meg Russell.
Thank you, Justine, and thank you for inviting me to this conference. I have to start by saying I'm a bit of a fish out of water on this panel, and in general at this conference, as a political scientist rather than a lawyer. So my focus is likely to be somewhat different to my fellow panellists. Lord Sumption's core concern is what he called the decline of politics and the rise of law to fill the void. I share his grave concerns about one of those things, and the other I'll largely steer away from delicately and leave to others to discuss. The decline of politics is a serious worry. When I say politics, I mean it in the sense articulated clearly by Lord Sumption and by Professor Bernard Crick in his classic and important book, In Defence of Politics, published in 1962. As Sumption says, the first task of any political system is to accommodate differences. So for Crick, politics was what he called a great and civilising human activity. It comprised the necessary discussion, negotiation, confronting of difficult choices, and compromise to make decisions in the nation's broad interests. As Crick said, to renounce or destroy politics is to destroy the very thing which gives order to the pluralism and variety of civilized society. Crick's work was important not only for defining politics, but also its alternatives. As he put it, tyranny is the most obvious alternative, oligarchy the next most obvious. Published just 17 years after the end of the war, many readers will have been well aware of those alternatives. More than 40 years later, in 2005, I revisited some of Crick's themes in a Fabian Society pamphlet entitled Must Politics Disappoint? There were by then already concerns about things identified by Lord Sumption, such as declining electoral turnout and membership of political parties. In my piece, I counterposed politics against some of the possible threats. For example, I suggested that the environment for politics was increasingly hostile in a world of growing consumerism, a world where people were better educated and wealthier, but where they were bombarded by messages from advertisers telling them they deserve to get what they want. The logic of politics is, of course, fundamentally different from that of consumerism. Decisions are collective, not individual, and compromise means we can't all get what we want. One of the big changes of recent decades is that, thanks to opinion polling, we increasingly better understand citizens' attitudes to politics. What we learn is that they don't like it very much. This has several consequences. One is that politicians grow fearful of taking difficult decisions, and hence want to distance themselves from the essence of politics itself. Political scientists note a trend of depoliticisation, where politicians hand powers to regulators and other unelected bodies. Lord Sumption's rise of law to fill the void fits neatly into that. But one key question he never entirely answered is who's to blame if such a change has occurred. As a stern defender of politics and of politicians, I have to say much of the blame lies with them. So this arguably represents more of a surrender of power by politicians than a power grab by judges. Another consequence of understanding citizens' distaste for politics is widespread and increasingly vicious criticism of it by the media and, more paradoxically, by politicians themselves. Electoral politics is by its nature competitive and tough, and politicians use what tools they can to gain advantage, including bad-mouthing the other side. But this is strange behaviour for a profession. Imagine if Ford sought to sell more cars by saying that those made by Fiat, Honda and Vauxhall were all unroadworthy, and if the others did the same. Trust would fall, car sales would fall, and that would be to the detriment of all. They don't do that, of course. Indeed, furthermore, they have an industry association where they join and lobby together in the common interest. Sadly, nobody does that for politics. Another question not thoroughly answered by Lord Sumption is what needs to be done. Perhaps unsurprisingly, it's a difficult question. In 2005, I suggested a collective voice was needed to defend politics, to communicate its nature and purpose, be honest about its shortcomings, but also be clear about the risk of the alternatives. That's never happened, and in today's environment, with the collapse of the political centre, the growth of populism, attacks on civil servants, parliament and judges, the need is significantly more urgent than it was then. It's perhaps ironic that the rallying cry for politics has come from a judge. But I hugely welcome this, and I hope Lord Sumption is ready to help build a wider movement. You can count me in, and if others want to suggest how to get the movement going, let's start doing that today. I could say much more, both about the problems and the possible solutions, but I'll leave it there, and I hope we might get to more of that.
Professor Vernon Bogdanore.
Like Meg Russell, I'm a fish out of water because I'm not a lawyer either. And I think I should begin by thanking Lord Sumption not only for the lectures, but for coming today to what he must regard as the proceedings of a fairly hung jury. The lectures make very wide claims, but then qualify them. For example, the argument that there's too much law is a result, he says, of the arrival of a broadly based democracy between the 1860s and the 1920s. But in questioning, he said to Helena Kennedy that he was not opposed to the expansion of the domain of law. All that I'm doing is pointing out that it has expanded, and the reason why I'm doing that is to try to explain why it is that law has acquired a greater space in our lives, and then accepts that collective action may require legal solutions, as of course it does. Then he is sceptical of arguments concerning inherent rights, which should be a matter of political choice, and any disagreement on their scope should be decided by the political process. But he does accept there should be a Human Rights Act, and surely such an act can only operate effectively if there's an independent check on political power to discover when the exercise of that power conflicts with rights. Otherwise, the rights are empty of content, and what agency can conduct that independent check unless it's a court? Then, dealing with the United States, he says the law simply has no solution to the problem of majoritarian tyranny. But then he says the law can protect minorities identified by some personal characteristics, such as race. And the lectures give the general impression that Lord Sumption's unhappy about the way the world is going, but it's not wholly clear why. But the one thing he's absolutely certain about is that referendums have no place in our democracy. He's particularly opposed to the 2016 one, but wants another one now to correct the error made by the people in the first. And cites Burke and argues that Parliament is an arena which can secure compromise. And Bernard Crick, as has been said, sees the essence of politics as compromise. It isn't. It's in making decisions. And a decision requires a yes or no vote. The European Communities Bill in 1972 required a yes or no vote. The withdrawal required a yes or no vote. That is not different from the decision the people are asked to make when a decision is transferred to them as, in effect, a third chamber of Parliament. And of course, Burke was writing before the age of party whips, when MPs were more independent than they are now. And for that reason, legislative scrutiny in the Commons does not generally rely in major changes to government legislation, except perhaps when there's a hung Parliament, and Lords' amendments critical of the government tend not to be accepted again, except in current circumstances. But if the decision had been left to Parliament, the vote, of course, would have been for Remain. And it appears from the referendum the majority of voters are not Remainers. And so if you oppose the 2016 referendum, you are arguing that Britain should remain in the European Union, even though a majority of people do not wish to do so. And Brexit, I think, shows how the political system can fail, since all three parties, major parties, favoured a Remain vote, but clearly a majority of people did not. Lord Sumption is worried, as many were, about the decline in engagement, but the referendum led to a turnout of 72%, the highest vote in any national election since 1972. We were worried about political apathy. That worry seems now to have disappeared. We worry perhaps about the opposite. So the case for the referendum is when the party system doesn't work, when political processes are not working, and in particular to secure legitimacy for a decision to transfer the powers of Parliament either upwards to Europe or downwards to devolution. And that is a clear principle of liberal thought, as in John Locke's Treatise of Government. The legislative cannot transfer the power of making laws to other hands. It being but a delegated power from the people, they who have it cannot pass it to others. And I think it's the only constitutional weapon for entrenchment that we have in an unwritten constitution marked by the doctrine of parliamentary sovereignty. Now, on the question of rights, we should rely, it said, on more political processes. And part of the argument is based on American experience. And although I disagree with what's said about America, America is a very untypical country because the courts there play a much larger role than in most other democracies because of the huge issue of race, which has cut across the American system since its foundation. And many of the key Supreme Court decisions are based upon race. And some of the decisions which are controversial, which are mentioned in the lectures, matters like abortion and economic regulation and so on, are matters to do with regulations between the federal government and the states. You may think abortion's right or wrong. It can't be right in Kansas and wrong in Nebraska, so it seems to me. And the only body that can arbitrate on those federal issues is, of course, a court. But suppose political processes are not working effectively or not protecting the rights of citizens. Sumption favours PR and open primaries, but these are not cure-alls. How would they have dealt with problems such as the white primary in America, literacy tests and gerrymandering of constituencies, all designed to prevent Afro-Americans exercising their voting rights? And in America, the court has helped to alter public opinion when President and Congress would not act. So surely the role of a court is to protect those minorities who cannot protect themselves via the political and electoral process. If a decision of Parliament does not result from a properly democratic process, is it not proper for the courts to intervene? And in dealing with process, are the courts really at risk of imposing their own values upon the country? Because clearly an elected majority in a democracy cannot do what it likes. It must be restricted, and the proper extent of majority rule cannot be left to the majority itself to decide. And in particular, when we're talking about unpopular minorities who, unlike Afro-Americans in America or Muslims here, cannot get into the electoral process, minorities like asylum seekers, suspected terrorists, or prisoners. Now, this is all particularly relevant today because Brexit returns us to an unprotected constitution, the only democracy without a constitution except for New Zealand and Israel. Israel's developing one. And when Israel had the basic law in 1992, Human Dignity and Liberty, providing that a law which contravened the rights enumerated in it would be unconstitutional, her Supreme Court president said it took Israel out of its isolation. Now, we are going back into that isolation. And so I end with two questions which I leave to you. Is there anything special about the air in Britain that makes it impossible to do what almost every other democracy has done, to draw up and enact a codified constitution? And secondly, the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights, which we are withdrawing from, will still be in force in the other 27 member states. Do you think our legislators are so much more sensitive to issues of human rights than legislators in the other 27 member states of the European Union that they should be entrusted with this vital function? I leave the answers to those questions to you. Thank you.
Last but not least, Lord Dyson.
Well, as anyone who knows Jonathan Sumption would expect, his Reith lectures are extremely interesting, beautifully expressed. The issues that he has raised are being discussed widely, as has been said already, and certainly not just at conferences like this. And this is a very good thing. But there is much in the lectures that I'm afraid I strongly disagree with. His thesis seems to be that in recent years, the power of judges, who are unaccountable, has been increasing at the expense of politics, and politics is shorthand for Parliament and the executive, which is, of course, accountable to Parliament. And secondly, that this is not a good thing in a democracy such as ours. As he acknowledges, judges have always made law. Some of the landmark decisions, common law decisions, in the evolution of that common law have been breathtakingly bold. They affect the lives of all of us. Some of these decisions have been far more important than cases such as the Prince of Wales correspondence case, which he talks about at some length in the second lecture. Our common law is one of the jewels of our constitutional arrangements, and Lord Sumption does not appear to disagree with that. One wonders why not. It may be a reductio ad absurdum to say it, but one might have expected his argument to be that judges should not make law at all, we should have a detailed written code, and that the role of judges should merely be to apply it. I accept that in recent years, judges have been exercising power in areas where they didn't do before. The scope of judicial review has been increased by the judges by a relaxation of the austere test of irrationality. And although proportionality has not quite, at least I don't think it has, because I'm a bit out of touch now, but I don't think proportionality even today has quite been recognised as the common law test or touchstone for judicial review, but we seem to be getting very close. This has been, in my view, because of the influence of the Human Rights Act, the Convention on Human Rights, and EU law. But the increase in judicial power should not be overstated and presented as some sort of revolution. Most judges, I believe, tend to be cautious. In judicial review, they are aware of the need for deference. I know that word is not a very attractive word, but we all know what it means, of the need for deference or to allow a generous area of judgment to the decision maker. There are areas of policy into which the courts continue to refuse to go, and rightly so, in my view. The difficult borderline cases are the ones that attract the most attention and where the appellate courts are most likely to be split. But most successful judicial review challenges are successful on the grounds of procedural error rather than on the merits. I don't understand, I'm afraid, why Jonathan Sumption gives top billing to the tragic case of Charlie Gard as an example of judicial power, although he does not say it was wrongly decided. It seems to me that this was a classic case, a very sad case, where there was a disagreement between parents and the medical authorities as to what was in the child's best interests. And who else can decide an issue of that kind other than the courts? And the courts made a decision. And so I don't see, although the facts are striking and tragic, I really don't see how that case is illustrative of any expansion of judicial power or judicial overreach. He discusses the application of the principle of legality in interpreting statutes. He says that this is an illustration of the exercise of judicial power. But he rightly acknowledges that it is, and I quote, a valuable technique for ascertaining what Parliament really intended. He discusses two cases in which the principle was applied. The first, the Unison case, he says the application there was perfectly orthodox, his words, not mine. And he applied the principle of legality, he calls it legitimacy, but it's the same thing, in the Privacy International case as well. He disagrees with the majority decision in the Prince of Wales correspondence case in what seems to me to be surprisingly polemical language. In fact, it was a difficult borderline case in which the Supreme Court was split. It seems to me that this is hardly a sound basis for a general complaint of excessive exercise of judicial power at the expense of politics. He's very critical of the expansionist interpretation of convention rights by Strasbourg, and says that the judges of that court have extended the convention rights too far and into controversial areas. As has been said, he focuses in particular on Article 8. He says this should be done through the political process. I accept that the expansion cannot be denied, but I would make these points. When the Human Rights Act was enacted, the UK government knew precisely that the Strasbourg courts had adopted the living instrument approach and indeed expressed the hope that our judges, and again I quote, would be able to contribute to this dynamic and evolving interpretation of the convention. So Parliament went into this with its eyes wide open. Secondly, our judges are not obliged to follow Strasbourg jurisprudence, although I do of course accept that they usually do. Our judges cannot strike down legislation that is incompatible with the convention, although, again, I accept that declarations of incompatibility usually do lead to changes. And Strasbourg can be persuaded to change its mind. And it is notable that the court in more recent times has been allowing a more generous margin of appreciation to the member states, a very important point. And finally, it is always, of course, open to Parliament to abrogate the Act. So we need judges to interpret statutes. There's nobody else who's going to do it for us. And we need judges to decide whether the executive has acted unlawfully. And I agree very much with the points that Lord Faulkner was making when he spoke a little while ago. On the whole, I think our judges are trusted to make sensible decisions. I suppose I would say that, wouldn't I? And how do I prove it? Well, I can't really prove it, but it is interesting that the opinion polls do show that judges now are respected and trusted and amongst the most popular cohort of people in the country, which was not the case when I started as a judge. I accept, of course, that judges do have, as Lord Sumption says, their prejudices and subjective values, but so do everybody else. And there's nothing very remarkable about that. But they are intelligent, independent, and free from political pressure. The current chaotic political climate is hardly, it seems to me, the right environment in which to take powers away from the judges. Jonathan does not identify a principle by which one should distinguish between those political issues which fall outside the proper domain of the law, or indeed a mechanism by which such issues can be decided. I say, leave well alone. Thank you.
LawPod UK was presented by Emma Louise Fenlon and is produced by One Crown Office Row. For more editions of LawPod UK, you can subscribe to the podcast and recommend us to a friend.